What does it take to make workshops work? And how can we facilitate collaboration that sticks and leads to results? My name is Miriam Hartness, and with the Workshops Work podcast, I'm on the mission to find the magic ingredients that make workshops work. Today with me on the show is Kate Quarshaw, and we speak about role play as an activity and a method within facilitation, and why it might make sense to hire professional actors to do the role play. So stay tuned. And by the way, if you don't have pen and paper at hand to take your own notes, scroll down to the show notes to download my free one-page summary. And now, lean back to be inspired. Hello, Kate. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam. It's bittersweet because I know when this podcast ends, you'll be leaving Australia.
That's true. It's my very last itinerary item.
I feel very, very, very special. So thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Thank you for making the time. We had a conversation recently where you shared that you're working with professional actors to introduce role play in your workshops. And I was so intrigued that I had to invite you on this conversation to learn more about that on behalf of the audience. And before we're getting there, I always start with the same question. Surprise! When did you start calling yourself a facilitator? And actually, do you?
Well, I wanted to be subversive and say, yes, I do call myself a facilitator, but I don't really. I definitely facilitate. I think there's an important element of creating space for learning and creating a sense of safety and engagement for people. So they want to learn the skills that I'm introducing them to in the workshop. Definitely, there are parts of the workshops that I run where it is facilitating conversation. So I use an experiential learning model, which involves a lot of reflection to embed learning. So in that space, I feel very much that I'm holding that space as a facilitator. But I don't see myself as a traditional facilitator. So whether that's my mental model that's incorrect or I'm not sure, I'd actually call myself a coach more than a facilitator.
Interesting. And where do you see the difference?
For me, I feel like when, as a facilitator, you're really taking the group on a shared learning journey or shared, you know, a shared outcome. For me, with the work I'm doing, I'm really emphasizing the individual skill training, improvement, the building of confidence in that individual setting. And that's for a number of reasons. One, I think people are quite disengaged from corporate learning. So I really want to identify that people, you know, that this is actually really purely about them and that the skills they take, they can use them anywhere.
Yeah. Sounds as if the outcome of a facilitative process are more tangible.
Yes. Yes, I would agree. I'd agree. And, you know, while in an ideal world, and I am quite an idealistic person, an organization will embed the learning in a workshop, but that often doesn't happen. So I do see the benefit of creating kind of individual benefits and individual what's in it for me to engage people and really get them to think about, okay, I can use this in lots of ways, even if I love the organization at the moment, even if I think they suck.
Yeah. Nice. And so you mentioned that you're mostly doing experiential learning and you take your groups onto a journey. And as I mentioned in the intro, you're using professional actors.
I am.
How did this come about? If I remember correctly, you do have a background in theater.
I do have a background in theatre. I did some training in London many years ago, but I never used it professionally. I met the co-founder of Sirius Wu a number of years ago, Trudy Boatwright, who is a professional actor and had done a lot of role play. And it was really a meeting of the minds. She was interested in using these techniques more broadly and starting her own business. And I had just left working in organizations and also in agencies doing strategy and communication strategy and was very frustrated by the blocks that I'd seen around change management, around culture, around organizational development. So we really brought those two together. Mm-hmm. And having some experience was great, but I definitely have learned a lot along the way.
So where was the frustration coming from and what was the solution?
Well, I would love to say that I have solved the challenges of change management and organizational development. Unfortunately, that's still a work in progress. However, I am a systems thinker. And for me, you know, a challenge around strategy or communication was never, ever going to be fit in a silo. And the work I did, people were still in a very siloed way of thinking, very top-down change, that kind of thing. And that was something that, you know, that I found very difficult. And I used to do a lot of strategy work and I'd call it, it's like the Ark of the Covenant from Indiana Jones. Mm-hmm. Remember Raiders of the Lost Ark, where everyone was desperate for the Ark of the Covenant, people died, you know, tragedy ensued. But then when we got the Ark of the Covenant, we didn't know what to do with it and it ended up in our archive box, in an underground bunker.
I never, yes, true, like the 42 in The Hitchhiker's Travel Through the Galaxy. Now we have the answer to all the questions. What was the question again?
Yeah, totally. And I got really frustrated by this, but I knew that I loved running workshops at the start of strategy projects. So I was looking for that working satisfaction and bringing the skills from doing the simulated role play with the actors, was able to start bringing the skills where people could at least discuss challenges. Because often, you know, when we're looking at strategy rollout, any kind of change, it is the friction that people have in having conversations, in calling things out, in being able to pause on their own, you know, mindset of how things should be done and allowing others to speak and collaborating, which for me is such a bedrock that can solve a lot of organizational issues.
So if I understand it correctly, it's at the beginning to create a framework or context where everyone looks at it and then can discuss it instead of being too much involved themselves.
I think it's having the skills to be able to co-design properly when we're developing strategy, when we're looking at any kind of business transformation. We need those skills. We also need those skills when we're trying to engage people to change.
And what skills are we talking about?
That's a good point. So for me, I call them interpersonal skills, mainly that it is around communication. So the workshops that I run are specifically, or predominantly, I should say, around courageous conversations. So that can look like anything from change transformation. It can look at respectful workplaces, mental health conversations, performance management, all those kind of things. It doesn't really matter what the title is. Ultimately, the elements are the same. And that's really how do we interact with someone in a way that's open, it's non-judgmental, where we're actually listening and we're trying to build on ideas.
Yeah, and we briefly talked about that before we hit the record button, how difficult it is sometimes to swallow our own medicine. And I had it yesterday in our long conversations, frustrated with customer services, where I would love to be this kind of calm person who goes through all the details and, yes, meets her conversation partners with all those patients. And then sometimes it just doesn't work. And it's especially when they're big emotions involved, right? So in change processes and strategy, when we have skin in the game, or maybe if there's a change we don't want, what is the magic? How can we learn to become better communicators?
There's so many parts of the magic. And I think one of the biggest ones is listening.
Mm.
And we hear about deep listening and listening to understand and active listening and all this kind of thing. And I try very hard. But I was actually blown away by a workshop participant a couple of weeks ago. I was running a difficult conversations program for a customer service team and we were working with the actors and someone came up to participate and they said, "Oh, I don't hear very well in this ear. I've just got to make sure that I can hear properly." Absolutely, no problem. We started the role play and she exhibited some of the best listening skills that I've ever seen. And I thought about it later and I thought because she's coming in thinking that she cannot listen well, so she is trying her best to listen. And I was like, that is so interesting, because I've heard of people saying, you know, listen with the, you know, the idea that you are wrong and you're looking for, you know, someone to prove that you're wrong and that kind of thing. But just ultimately starting a conversation where you at a baseline say, I'm not a very good listener because I can't listen well. And going in with this mindset, I just found it absolutely mind-blowing how different, how much better she was at listening compared to the majority of people that I've worked with.
Yeah. And what a beautiful humility then for oneself. I can imagine, especially if we have maybe, if we know that we have some sort of attention disorder, or if we struggle because we have something else on our mind, then just to remind ourselves, okay, today I might not be a good listener, and maybe even warn our partner. I wonder whether there's a difference between I cannot listen well versus I cannot hear well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I understand that, but I wonder if we change our mindset to I can't hear well, whether we'll actually listen better.
Yes. Yeah. And I can also imagine that when we think that we are not hearing well, or when we're indeed not hearing well, we might use more the way of paraphrasing. Okay, if I heard correctly, this is what you said.
And paraphrasing is one of the things that I talk a lot about in the workshops. And paraphrasing, it's kind of clunky and uncomfortable and no one wants to do it, but it makes an immense amount of difference, not just for, you know, if you're paraphrasing the conversation that you're hearing, but you ask the person that you're talking to paraphrase the what they've understood before you end the conversation, because it still can be very different. And I think speed is another thing that is a big issue in these conversations that I see a lot. One is the slowness of actually getting to the point of the conversation at the start, but then moving quickly because you're wanting to desperately get the conversation over and done with. And then you are so relieved that you've actually passed on the issue. Miriam, you're coming late to class and I need you to be there on time because the rest of the group is, you know, is waiting for you, whatever it is. You know, people are so desperate to get over that bit that in their minds, the conversation's over. But they haven't actually worked out a plan.
And they haven't thought of the other person, that they might need to digest it, that they might have heard something else. They might have made something else out of that piece of information. So instead of, okay, that's okay, let's acknowledge that I've been late and I promise not to do it again. Suddenly, maybe in my mind, oh my goodness, she's judging me. I'm not good enough. I make the group work, wait. And then all of that is going on for me. And then I'm totally distracted and unable to listen for the reminder.
Yes. And I think, you know, another thing that we all have to work with at the moment is where everyone's nervous systems are at. Globally, maybe. So when we think about, you know, when we're in that sympathetic nervous system state, when we're in amygdala hijack, we actually, one, our hearing's affected, so we actually hear more acutely, but we filter out the words. So if we're stressed, we're actually constantly just checking for the words that will let us know whether we need to flee the situation or not. Because as humans, you know, we have this amazing nervous system, but we can't differentiate between a physical threat and a psychosocial threat. So me saying to you, Miriam, you've kept the class waiting, could be the same as me chasing you down the street with a knife. That's what our nervous system is working out.
Yeah.
So, you know, once you're in that zone, and you could be in that zone because you've come to work after a really crappy morning, like people don't know, you know, but once you're in that state, you're listening, your executive function is out the window.
Yeah.
So there's so many layers of complexity, and this is why slowing down, making sure we listen, giving people space, giving people the option about whether they are okay to have this conversation right now are all such important things.
Yeah. And then even in the pace, there are so many layers, because if a person has a tendency to be impatient, and I can sometimes be that person, and then a conversation is taking a lot of time, I really get impatient, and then also my mind goes elsewhere and I lose focus.
Yeah. It's really tricky. And one thing I recommend for people who do have that struggle is to take notes when they're having a conversation. So
to keep the mind busy.
Well, it's, yeah, keep yourself focused on the activity. And it's also showing people that this is, you know, this is for kind of sit down, you know, deeper conversations. But by doing that, you're showing, okay, Miriam, I really want to understand what you have to say, so I'm going to take notes. It slows the conversation down. And it also means that if you are someone who thinks that they capture the essence of the conversation well, which is me, but I don't, and I'm forever coming out of meetings going,
oh my God, what did they say?
But getting now into that practice of note taking,
yeah,
it's really, really helpful.
Yeah. And the paraphrase, so if we're taking notes, then also the paraphrasing will be easier.
Absolutely.
And what I realize with paraphrasing, I do it in workshops. So if someone shares something, I try to paraphrase to acknowledge, but also to just use different words to make sure that everyone else has understood and whether I got it correctly on behalf of the participants. And I realized that I also do it more and more in podcast interviews, that if my guest is sharing something that is maybe a little bit more complex or longer, I try to paraphrase it just to make sure that those in the audience, if their mind has wandered somewhere, that I bring them back and that we're all on the same page. And also to make sure whether I actually understood it correctly so that we can move on.
And you're being very diplomatic, because you may find sometimes that your guests go on tangents too. It's good to rein them in, which I am one of those people that can go on tangents. But I think, yeah, so it's such an important skill. And, you know, I've learnt some humility about it. I work very closely with a workplace investigator lawyer, dear friend, Erica Edmonds, who does a lot of diversity and inclusion work, but also these investigations, which, you know, are very complex and sticky. And she's, you know, she's been doing this all her life. And I used to watch her write these detailed notes and think, it's a bit over the top. But, you know, now I realize she does it because she will never take the chance or the risk of not capturing what someone has to say really well. And I think it is really respectful.
Yeah.
And it's smart. So, yeah, I learned a lot from that.
Yeah, and it just gives the other person also this good, warm feeling of being heard and being listened to and being valued. Oh, what I'm saying is worth being written down. Mm. That feels good.
Yep. I advise people to let people know that they're taking notes, because where there's a lack of psychological safety, people may become suspicious and wonder why they're being used. So I think it's always much better, especially when you're online, because often you can write notes and people can't actually see what you're doing.
Yeah.
So I think it's very important to be explicit about the action and explain to people why you're doing so.
That's such a good point. That sometimes when I'm in a call with someone and then suddenly they say something, I'm like, oh, that could be interesting for the podcast. I start taking notes. And then I realize that they don't know
why I'm taking notes. And I don't want them to think that I'm stealing their ideas whatsoever, because we never know. And like, okay, step back. I'm taking notes because I thought you could be on the podcast, and then suddenly it makes sense. And yeah, unconsciously I've been doing that.
Excellent.
And since you spoke about diversity and inclusion, I have the impression that having candid conversations becomes more and more difficult, because on the one hand, we read so much in the media that it is more difficult to address people, and we hear about everyone becoming maybe a little bit more sensitive. So there's a lot of overthinking going on of how do we address someone? How do we speak about something? How can we actually raise criticism or candid feedback? To what extent can you train that with an organization? To what extent does it depend on an organizational culture, or is it something general going on?
It's a really good question. I think that it definitely depends on the culture, but I think some of that is around whether it's safe to make mistakes.
Mm.
When we learn something new, irrespective of our intent, we are going to make mistakes. And, you know, I've had situations where, even, you know, my children come in and, you know, that, oh, someone's angry at me because I've, you know, I've used a wrong pronoun, or I've done something, you know, like this. And I think the important thing is acknowledging that you made a mistake and that you're trying, and what's the best way of doing things. And often, like I've said, I've asked children, you know, the children, you know, are they snappy normally? You know, if you did something, would they bite back at you normally? And it's like, yes. And other people wouldn't. Other people would understand that, you know, if there's good intent there, if there's understanding there, if people are trying to change habits, that that's a good thing. Now, it's tricky in organizations because there's a lot of change resistance as well. So I think being able to create a culture, you know, I had a lot of conversations last week about International Women's Day and men standing up and being bystanders and calling out inappropriate behavior towards women. And there, you know, research says that if men do it in a space in front of men without women there, it's more effective, sadly, because it's not perceived as doing something, you know.
It's been not patronizing.
Yeah, it's not patronizing, or you're just doing it to impress, you know, impress and all that kind of thing. It's really challenging for men to do it. It's frustrating to watch that. But how do we solve this problem?
Mm-hmm.
We need to provide space for people to practice and to feel safe and to make mistakes. And unfortunately, as adults especially, we don't get the opportunity to practice these skills in a safe place.
Yes. And I, what comes to my mind is, you said behavioral change. And yes, changing our way to communicate is a behavioral change. And it feels clunky, and it is clunky in the beginning. So you're hosting these workshops to learn better ways of communication, how to go through difficult conversations. And then the workshop is over. And then how can we ever expect anyone to master it immediately? Don't they need a dojo, a place to actually practice? It's like, yeah, and I use the word dojo, which is for martial arts, right? So it's self-defense. And I think communication can also be a martial art.
Oh, in some sense. It is an art. It is absolutely an art. And it is something that needs practice. And I think because of COVID, because of lockdowns, we, you know, we were so process orientated and in survival mode, and we weren't really challenging anyone. We were just very locked down, worrying about what we needed to do to survive, understandably. You know, we've taken a step back in our ability to have these conversations. And I definitely have organizations that book regular conversation clinics where we go in and we practice, you know. So that may be just ongoing building of skills. It may be that some organizations book conversation clinics around particular times of the year, so for performance appraisals, that kind of thing. So that's, you know, that's really helpful. And also, because of the nature of working in that kind of space, it is very vulnerable. It's really effective for team development as well. So I do have a couple of clients that have scenarios for a leadership group to work on once a quarter with an actor, and just using that as kind of skills development in a different, you know, you're practicing your conversation skills, you're watching peers do approach a scenario in a different way, you're working out new ideas of how to approach that issue, and it also builds psychological safety and connection within the team.
And acknowledge that it's a skill that has grown over time and not in just one workshop. I love the idea of the conversation clinic. I think it's, yes, of course. Of course we need to practice. And you just mentioned again the actor.
Yes.
Can I double click on that?
Click, click.
So you're bringing in someone from external, and if I understand correctly, they would then play out the role of maybe an employee. So let's say it's a workshop on appraisal. Difficult end of year conversations.
Absolutely.
And then the actor would play the employee, and then they can basically train with the actor. What are the benefits of bringing someone external into this environment context instead of having just their peer playing out the employee, because they, air quotes, know the employees better?
Well, we definitely have to get the actors skilled up in the cultural nuances and the language of the organization and all that kind of thing, because it is really important to embody the organization as an actor. But one of the reasons we don't use our colleagues is because, Miriam, when I'm sitting next to you in the office every day and then you are playing the role of team coordinator who is not doing their reporting properly, you're not being yourself. I know that I can't play myself. I can't be myself in the training because there's cognitive dissonance. Like, and it also, you know, you might be very good at embodying that character, but generally you're not. And that is why selling role play, talking about role play to organizations, can be very difficult, because so many people have bad memories of bad role play in learning environments. And one of the issues, the actors that work with us at Sirius Woo aren't just actors. You can be a great actor and not a great role play actor, because the ultimate objective of the interaction with the participant and the actor is a learning outcome. So often if I'm working as an actor, I will have to take myself out of character. I'm constantly analyzing where the participant's at. So if you go in and you've done this before, you're very experienced, you're very self-aware, I'm going to up the ante because I want to give you a challenge. If you're very new to this kind of work, you're very nervous, you're overwhelmed, I'm not going to shame you and make you feel terrible. I'm going to try and give you some opportunities to practice from where you're at. So I might prompt you and say, sorry, Miriam, you're not being very clear. Or I might shift my body language to show you that, you know, I'm a bit upset by what you've just said, or whatever it is. So they're not necessarily always actorly cues or dialogue. We're really shifting from being an actor to being a coach or facilitator at once during that time.
I think true, then it becomes also more of an improvisation play or art, where they constantly have to react and play with what is offered to them by the staff, by the employees or the workshop participants.
There's no script. So if I have an actor coming in, well, there's a couple going out to do some mental health role plays today, there's a whole backstory that that character has. And so they will decide how much they will share with the participant based on the level of comfort, the level of trust, the kind of body language, the space that they give the person, all those things. So it's not that, oh, get into pairs for 5 minutes, go over there. Okay, you've learned this technique. Go and practice that with your partner. It's much more complex and nuanced than that.
I can perfectly see that now. So, and then they would do it in front of the entire group and then discuss about it?
We can do it a number of different ways. So you can do individual clinics. We do what we call forum theatre, which can be where you have an actor and participant in a group of people, and I will time out the conversation, will reflect where people are at. The participant can time out at any time and ask the group for ideas. So it is a very collaborative process. And then I will get the participant to swap out with another person, which is great for their active listening, because I won't say, okay, so this has happened in the conversation. Ideally, I won't say this. I'd like you to pick up.
And then I can imagine that the person who was just in the role play and now becomes a spectator looks at it in a very different way because they are directly affected.
They do look at it in a different way, and they can see different approaches to the same problem.
Yeah.
And this is one of the challenges we have with conversations, that when we have one, we're generally, we have it once,
yeah,
and we don't see the different ways that it could be approached.
Yeah.
And that's what the beauty is of being able to observe as well, because we can just see what a tiny shift in speed, how that can change the vibe, yeah, getting woo-woo, of the interaction.
Yeah.
You know, just these little tweaks, you know, we're looking at, you know, Atomic Habits 1%. What are those 1% tweaks that you can make to the way you interact with someone can actually have a massive impact on the relationships you have at work and the outcomes you have at work?
Yeah. And then I'm thinking back to the role plays as they're usually done. I'll pair up with a colleague and then play that through. And what are the biggest mistakes in there?
What are the biggest mistakes? I think it's just the, what we're trying to create with role play is the closest thing to being real.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're working with a colleague, it's not the closest thing to being real. There are some people that hate acting. They hate it. They will go, their brain will shut down. They won't be able to do it. There are some people that wanted to be actors and that opportunity has been ripped from them, and they will overact in these situations.
Yes, literally.
And also it's just the nuance of being able to slow down, being able to communicate how the way the participant is communicating to you impacts the conversation. You're just not going to get that feedback. It's not to say that there's no value in those kind of role plays. There is some, because it's good to practice. It's good to practice skills. We talk a lot about muscle memory and being able to have certain phrases that you can just quickly draw upon when you're feeling a bit elevated, yeah, in, yeah, a conversation.
Yeah, I was just thinking of these situations where often in role play, when at least one feels uncomfortable, suddenly instead of doing the role play, they will go into the meta conversation and just discuss how they would discuss,
yep,
and how they would play that situation out, which then puts them too much in their head and too far away from their gut and their heart and how they would actually intuitively,
yep,
speak out. And then it's a missed opportunity.
It's not easy work as well. That's often why people also, role play. I spend a lot of time creating a space where people can feel safe and vulnerable. And, you know, I've learned lessons along the way. I'm very explicit now about whether people, if people don't feel comfortable, that they have to explicitly tell me, because sometimes, you know, I'm on watching to see how people are going in when they're doing the exercise, but I don't know that person, their triggers, what, you know, something could affect them or what's going on in their life. And some people have a really good game face, and it's just good lessons in life. Like I had one situation a few weeks ago where I gave the option of someone, if someone wanted to stop, and I didn't think they did. They looked like they were doing a really good job, and they were just, yes, 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 I need to take a break. And they're really good lessons too. It's not always, you know, it's not just about doing things well that we get the lessons from.
Mm.
I was in a workshop last week and finishing up a program of workshops, and the organization has realized the deficit of some skills around dealing with mental health issues in the community. They're very customer facing because of being able to observe what's going on in a role play. So I love this work so much, Miriam, because it is the safest place to enact real life.
Yeah.
And so when you get that, it's almost, people are almost more comfortable to do it than if they were being observed in the workplace. And so there's so much juiciness that you can get out of it.
Yeah, and there's less judgment and it's more objective. On the other hand, I can imagine that you're briefing the actors, they're coming in, and I would love to hear more about the briefing. So how do they actually know how to play and what the culture is? Because I can also imagine that when they got the objective briefing, or maybe they even experienced it themselves, and then they acted out, and suddenly the employees see their culture acted out and don't want to see that, because there's a cognitive dissonance going on, like, okay, this is not how we see ourselves. And then they would reject that or feel defensive. Does it ever happen?
No.
Hmm.
No, I don't think, I haven't seen that as explicitly happen. What I tend to see is in some organizations where the executive culture is not as functional, that they will avoid participating more than rejecting what's going on actually in the work. So,
because they don't want to be confronted to it.
They don't want to be confronted because it's not a safe space. Honestly, it's, you know, you don't have to have absolute psychological safety to get people to participate at all. Like, you can create that, but there's only so much that you can create in a workshop. And especially where, you know, if you've got heavily politicized organizations, you know, that idea, the ruinous empathy, you know, people are reluctant to be in front of their peers because it exposes them. They're worried about judgment. They're worried about back channel chat, all those kind of things. And interestingly, it is not something I see happening a lot once people are in a workshop. It is more absenteeism in programs where you think, okay, that's interesting.
Fleeing is safer than fighting.
Yeah.
Would you use humor?
We definitely use humor in the context of ourselves. We're like, when I co-facilitate with a number of different organizations as well. We often collaborate with subject matter experts and bring the actors in. So, you know, one thing that I'm very clear on with my participants is that I can be really crap at what I'm teaching, and that this is a lesson in life. This is not a space where you want, here is Kate Crawshaw, the international expert in courageous conversations. And quite frankly, no one is. Like, it is about understanding that the uncomfortableness of having a conversation will never go away. However, your ability to understand process, to have the skills, to practice the skills, to make better outcomes for that conversation will be improved.
To pause before reacting, to just sense that, oh, what I'm about to say is not the smartest thing.
People are desperate to talk. I'm desperate to talk. Like I said to an executive team last month, you know, this was the CEO and the executives, I do not want you to speak until you count to two. Because we're constantly trying to cut.
Yeah.
We're constantly thinking ahead and desperately wanting to share that point of view.
Which then brings us back to the listening. If we just listen to reply, we don't really listen. And then we might not catch the final bits of the sentence. And hence, actually reply to something that is maybe not as valid because it's missing bits. And I was in such a conversation of a group of fast thinkers and fast speakers. And I was just wishing for a talking stick. Although this is, the talking stick seems really woo-woo. And still, I think there's so much value in slowing it down by design that you can only speak when someone put down the talking stick and you pick it up after. These are this 1, 2 counting.
The talking stick in itself as an object is not woo-woo at all. All it is a symbol to say, calm your farm, slow down. Like, that's really all it is. It's just that in our culture, we are so desperate to validate our expertise and show what we know.
Yeah.
Because whether it's because we're all, you know, because we all have deep insecurities, whatever it is, you know, but the talking stick is just an object. It just happens that there were cultures that used it really effectively that we struggle to understand or have not spent the time to understand. You know, generally, I think that's where people can, you know, they can kind of shut down, or they just don't like the fact that the talking stick means that they've got to shut down.
Yeah, so, it brings too much structure and conversation. To come back to the humor, because so I totally understand that you are using humor on yourself so that you don't take yourself 110% seriously and thereby also create a safe space for the others. What I also had in mind was using humor in the play. And what I have in mind with that is when asking two employees to act out a situation, they usually exaggerate in a way that everyone starts laughing because they just recognize themselves and the culture in that exaggerated play, which is a sort of humor. And I'm wondering, if you bring in an external actor to play out a conversation, can you still use this sort of humor? Because then you're suddenly making fun of someone else instead of making fun of yourself.
The nature of the conversation clinics or the work with the actors, the scenarios are difficult conversations. So, and there's not a lot of humor that is kind of embedded in there. Sometimes there is. It depends on the nature. We did have a situation where we're talking about appropriate behaviors, and one of the scenarios was about the fact that a penis had been drawn on a whiteboard in a remote office. And it was humorous because no one would call it a penis. So I found that quite funny. And what is that inappropriate object you're talking about? I think we might lack clarity here. However, we do interweave humor and fun into the workshops to get people to feel comfortable. Okay. So we'll do a lot of applied improv activities, different things to get people understanding, one, about habit, and two, that it's okay to make mistakes.
Yeah.
So they would be primarily the two themes. One of the challenges, which I'm sure you'll find, is that the amount of time that you're given to run these workshops is always quite limited. So applied improv activities are really quick ways of demonstrating our blocks, our habits, our go-tos, and then be able to challenge those safely when they come up in the role plays.
What's your favorite applied improv activity?
Oh, I've got a lot of
unusual one.
Unusual. Well, I don't know whether you think this is unusual or not, but when we were doing everything online, one of the things I used to love doing was grandmother's footsteps. I asked ChatGPT to give me all the different names of this globally. Oh, it's called red light, green light, or statues, or loulou in France. So it's where one person is at the front and they might have a little, I don't know, a rock or a stick between their legs, and everyone's got to walk up slowly, and when they turn around they freeze And if they move, they've got to go to the back of the line. But if they don't, they can continue. And the idea is being able to get the rock before the wolf catches them or the grandmother or whoever it is. And you can do this online by getting, I used to get a post-it note and just put it on the camera of the screen as the kind of, I've got the rock at the end. But it was just so much fun because one thing that drives me a little bit bonkers is when people think they can't move around or make noise in an online workshop because you can. And it's just such a random.
I would have never thought of using this exercise online.
Yeah.
And what a nice translation to the sticky note on the screen.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, we do have this game in, it's a children's game with a very inappropriate name. Yeah, I think it's Wer hat Angst vom schwarzen Mann? Who's afraid of the black man? That's the name in German. I'm sure that nowadays
probably a new changed, name.
Exactly. I'm sure that they changed the name since the 80s when I played it.
But
Grandmother's Footsteps.
Yeah, so I do love that. Yeah. I love that game.
And one question that I also love to ask all my podcast guests is, what is your number one challenge? Facilitation challenge, especially when it comes to the role play.
I still think it's listening and judgment. You know, I see a lot of these, and it's making sure I don't pattern match and say, oh, I can see what this person's going to do based on the first, you know, 30 seconds of interaction. I think it's, you know, keeping that open mind, being curious, deferring judgment.
Yeah. And what I just realized is you must have seen so many different reactions to the same scene in your life.
Yes.
Just this variety of, okay, X happens, and here are 20 different ways one can understand, interpret, react in this very specific situation. Would be nice to write it down if you haven't.
Yeah, I haven't written it down. It's interesting because, I mean, I think it's probably just practice, isn't it? Because I find it challenging to write down the experiences that, that you have in the workshop. And often they come so quickly and you're also aware of confidentiality and those kind of things. But obviously there'd be ways to get over that. But it's funny, there are a lot of different responses, but then there are a lot of similar responses as well.
And does it mostly depend on the organizational culture, on the personality types, on the maybe geographic culture?
I'm not sure about geographic culture because I've predominantly done this work only in Australia.
Which is very diverse culturally.
Yes, but no, you're right. You're right. I honestly think it's down to the individual. There are definitely cultural nuances. So there's certain body language and questioning authority. Those kind of things are differences that we'll see culturally. Absolutely. And I know that, you know, if you're looking more broadly, globally, there are cultures that speak more slowly. And those kind of things as well. So they're definitely all things to be aware of. Though I do think that if you fundamentally go down to the fundamentals of really deep listening like you can't hear, speed, open questions, clarifying, and make sure that your impatience or your judgment or your own pattern matching isn't going to interfere with any of that. I think in most situations, then you can have a cultural literacy and understanding.
And for the actors, it's a question that I wanted to ask earlier. It's not too late. How do you brief them? How do they get the information about the way to act out a certain company culture or context?
So there's a lot of work that goes into developing a scenario, working with the client about the objectives they want. Thereafter, really delving into their language, the acronyms they use, the slang, place names, all those kind of things, because there's nothing worse than describing a document management system incorrectly. That kind of, that's the thing that will kill the feeling of, you know, of being in that real situation. So we do a lot of work around that. We also do work around the models that we're teaching and the other skills that we're teaching, because we want the actor to kind of reward those behaviours. So there's lots of layers that the poor actor has to consider. Yep. And then there's their kind of backstory. So people are people. So there will be a layer of that organisational layer of technical speak and those kind of things. And we've had some challenging situations. We worked with engineers in an airport once, and they were blown away at the, you know, at the detail that had been, that we'd undertaken to get all that language right and all those kind of things. And you kind of have to do that because people are looking for a way out, some of those naysayers. So some people want an excuse not to engage, and that's another reason why we spend so much time on that detail, because you can't argue when it feels real.
Yeah, true. And it's so easy to be snapped out if it doesn't feel real. Mm. And as you say, it's one acronym that is wrong.
Totally.
Or you're not calling something by its acronym or its internal lingo.
Yep, absolutely. So we do that work. The actor will get, you know, a big kind of backstory of their personality, and then we always rehearse.
Yeah. And it's so good on an even deeper level layer, because this internal lingo creates trust almost automatically,
yep,
whether we want it or not. But we assume that it's our peer group if they speak our language. So if you're coming in as external speaking their language,
yep,
there is immediately this level of trust that they cannot fight against.
We do other, like, because in a workshop where often it's not just the conversation clinics, and I think audio is a really, really powerful tool that's not used enough in workshops. So I like, rather than saying to an organization, you know, there are a lot of people that are just sitting around waiting to retire and you're not having conversations with them, to create that as a script and record it and say, do you hear any of these kind of conversations around your organization where it's like, oh, you know, Peter, God, oh, I'm not going to ask him, he's just sitting there.
So you would play pre-recorded snippets that you picked up from your research and then play it out, instead of what I hear other facilitators do is that they would write it on sticky notes and put it on the wall.
Yep.
But you would actually record it and let people listen to these snippets read out by,
yep,
actors, I guess. That's so strong.
You want an emotional connection to the work,
yeah,
that you do. And that's why, you know, acting, other kind of theatre techniques that you bring into a workshop can be so impactful, because that emotional connection is more likely to drive us to reflection, conversation and change.
Yeah. Yeah. And what makes a workshop fail, according to you?
For me, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why a workshop can fail within a workshop, and some of those are in your control, some of those are outside of your control. My challenge to myself is trying to engage and motivate people enough that they will continue to practice outside of the workshop. Mm. For me, it's not about the workshop. And we know, like, Ebbinghaus's forgetting curve absolutely haunts me, where it's something like, you know, you'll lose 75% of all workshop content within 72 hours if you don't practice. Mm. Now, that is massive, and there's very few workshops that's set up to embed practice before. So for me, it's really making sure that I have spent enough time working with the participants to identify what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, hoping that that's been enough for to motivate them to keep going and doing things, because it's hard work, but it's work that can change your life, I believe.
What else is there to say?
Get on the plane, Miriam.
Amen. Thank you so, so much for this rich and eye-opening conversation.
It's been a pleasure, and it's been a joy to have you in Melbourne, and hopefully you will come back and visit soon.
For sure. For sure. First thing I would do when I'm back in Amsterdam is book my train, my plane ticket.
Your tram ticket.
My tram ticket. See you next time. And see you at NDP.
Yes. Yes, yes.
Thank you for staying tuned and for listening to the show. I know how busy you are, and I appreciate that you're sharing your two most valuable resources with me and my guest, your time and your attention. If you're looking for more conversation with other facilitators and for a community of practice, why don't you join Never Done Before, the community that I have built and many of my podcast guests are already members. Visit neverdonebefore.org, and I wish to see you there.